It helps us remember how things tie together. When you learn these, if you take a moment and you just run through them in your mind or say them out loud, it will provide you with an excellent review of the book. It's just a really good way to help remember this. So, chapter 1. All right, the ascension, and Matthias replaces Judas. Chapter 2 is Pentecost. Chapter 3 is, all right, lame man healed in second sermon. Then chapter 4 is Peter and John arrested. Chapter 5, Sapphira. There we go, Ananias, Sapphira, all the apostles arrested. Chapter 6, the seven chosen to serve. And then chapter 7, yep. If y'all noticed, I've gotten better at not skipping chapter 7. Because the chapter 6 had the word 7 in it, I always wanted to go to chapter 8 immediately. But chapter 7 is Stephen's speech and death. Chapter 8. All right, yes, church is scattered. Philip preaches in Samaria and to the eunuch. Then in chapter 9, we have the conversion of Saul and the story of Dorcas. Then in chapter 10, we have the conversion of Cornelius. Chapter 11, Peter explains Cornelius. Gospel goes to Antioch. Chapter 12, James is killed and Peter is delivered. And really, that's the end of the first half of the book, if you want to call it half. And I know if you're really hung up on math, it's technically not the halfway point, you know. But that's the first big section of the book. And then chapter 13, we have the first journey, Cyprus and Antioch. And keep in mind, on these journeys, I'm not naming every one of the places, but what we've done is pick the most prominent of them. But Cyprus and Antioch, and it was on the island of Cyprus that Saul's name began to be called Paul, wasn't it? Or as he left there, we see him being called Paul. Chapter 14. First journey ends and Iconium and Lystra. Chapter 15, we have discussion of circumcision at Jerusalem. And then chapter 16, second journey, Philippi. Chapter 17, second journey, Thessalonica, Berea, and Athens. Then to where we are today, chapter 18 is second journey still, and we have Corinth and then Apollos. Bring him in. Chapter 19, third journey, Ephesus. And chapter 20, the return to Jerusalem and Ephesian elders, or back to Jerusalem, however you want to say it. All right, we are on the second journey. And let's just think about this one, how all the journeys originate from Antioch, the three preaching journeys. You know, some of your Bible maps will have the four journeys of Paul, the fourth one being the journey to Rome, and that one won't start at Antioch. But we start up here at Antioch, and it's been quite an eventful trip, hasn't it? It was eventful before it even started, because Paul and Barnabas split up. Barnabas goes to Cyprus. Who does Paul choose to go with him on this second journey? Silas. And along the way, what two men join them? Timothy and Luke. Where does Timothy join them? At Lystra. You know, they work their way from Antioch. They come up here through Cilicia. They come through Iconium. You know, I mean, Phrygia, Pamphylia, this area, also known as southern Galatia. But at Lystra, Timothy joins the group. Do you remember where Luke joined them? Over at Troas, here on the edge of the Aegean Sea. And, of course, now Luke doesn't stay with him very long, does he? Where does Luke drop out? Not in the same way that John Mark did, but he seems to have stayed behind at what city? At Philippi. And I mean, we're not told with certainty, but every indication is that Luke stays at Philippi for an extended period of time. But they go on from Philippi. We've talked about Thessalonica, Berea, Athens. And then they came down to Corinth. Corinth is the largest city in Achaia, or southern Greece. It was the political capital. It was the economic center. Now, what was the cultural center of Achaia? Athens. You know, Athens had that historical tradition about it. It had the culture. But Corinth is the booming big city. And I know you've talked about this last week. And, you know, it was a city known for its immorality, its ungodliness. How much time does Paul spend there? It mentions a year and a half in verse 11. A year and 6 months. Now, there's still a question as to whether verse 18, so Paul still remained a good while, that is, after that uproar where they led him before Gallio, is the good while after the 18 months, or is it included in the 18 months? And I just don't know. But 18 months is, to this point, the longest it would appear he stayed anywhere on one of these preaching journeys. This is his longest stay, and, you know, keep that in mind. The mention of Gallio is important. He's a fellow, we can read about him in Roman records. The brother of Seneca, a prominent Roman of the first century. But one of the keys is, to me, it gives you one of those time markers. From the Roman records, Gallio was the proconsul about A.D. 52. So, you know, we have the death of Herod in A.D. 44, back in chapter 12. You know, here we have Gallio in A.D. 52. You know, those are, you know, the kind of places we can put down a marker and we can say, well, we kind of have a general idea of where we are time-wise. But from Corinth, he wrote two letters. What two letters do we have that he wrote? First and Second Thessalonians. And I'm not going to go back through those, but he has sent a letter back up. You know, he's down at Corinth. He sends this letter up to Thessalonica. And in that first letter, he says a lot about his concern for them. I just want to encourage you all to take a few moments, not right now, stay with me for the next few minutes, but it's somewhat, read 1 Thessalonians 2, 1 through 12. See the heart of Paul as he talks about his concern for them, the way he worked with them. It gives you a real insight into what the heart of a teacher ought to be. And I think it's really instructive. But in the second half of chapter 4, first half of chapter 5, what's the subject in 1 Thessalonians? The second coming of Christ. And it gets some prominent mention in the second letter. But in the second letter, what's the first half of chapter 2 talk about? The revealing of what man? The man of sin. And it's one of those times where you're glad this is just a survey and an overview, and I don't have to explain the man of sin. Now that 2 Thessalonians 2 may be the most difficult section in Paul's writings. I mean, if it's not, it's right up there with, you know, it's a tough little section. Chapter 3 is a warning about, or instructions on how to deal with what people? The disorderly, the unruly, those who were idle and not walking according to the traditions. And he tells them, you know, to admonish them, to withdraw from them. That's chapter 3. Now let's get back to Acts 18. We've gotten those letters and remembering when they're set. And at the end of what you studied Wednesday night, they brought Paul before Gallio. And what Gallio says in verse 14 and 15, It's not just that it saves Paul from imprisonment, from a beating. Gallio, a Roman proconsul, basically says to the people, this is an internal matter among you Jews. For the moment, Christianity is not branded as any kind of false, you know, a religion that's a threat to the Roman Empire. Down the road, the Romans will outlaw Christianity. For the first, you know, half of the first century, and really even beyond that, the Roman government had no beef, as it were, with Christianity. They just regarded it as another sect of Judaism. And while there were times, as in when the emperor commanded all the Jews to leave Rome, the Jews were kind of on the outs, it was not a banned religion. It was not forbidden. So what happens, you know, here is a statement of, it's okay. You know, we're not, you know, going to kick you out. Now, you have, you know, Paul, after this all happens, he decides to stay a while. Let's read starting at verse 18. Before I do that, any leftover comments, questions from while I was gone, because Steve's in the back, I'll give him the microphone, he can answer those. No, anything before we pick back up. All right, let's look at 18. So Paul still remained a good while. Then he took leave of the brethren and sailed for Syria, and Priscilla and Aquila were with him. He had his hair cut off at Cenchrea, for he had taken a vow. And he came to Ephesus and left them there. But he himself entered the synagogue and reasoned with the Jews. When they asked him to stay a longer time with them, he did not consent, but took leave of them, saying, I must by all means keep this coming feast in Jerusalem, but I will return again to you, God willing. And he sailed from Ephesus. And when he had landed at Caesarea and gone up and greeted the church, he went down to Antioch. After he had spent some time there, he departed and went over the region of Galatia and Phrygia in order, strengthening all the disciples. He stays a good while, and then he leaves. Who is with Paul when he leaves Corinth? Aquila and Priscilla. Who are Aquila and Priscilla? They are tent makers. They are tent makers who had left when Claudius commanded the Jews to depart from Rome. Paul had become closely associated with them. You just watch them through Paul's letters, how often they are referenced. And they're a little bit nomadic. I think I figured up one time that Aquila, at the very least, lived in at least five different places, you know, or moved, meaning he'd moved at least four times based on what said. I mean, we know, look, he's from Pontus. He had lived in Rome. Now he's in Corinth. That's three. When Paul writes Romans, he'll be back in Rome. So, you know, he moves about a little bit. He's not one of those people that like to stay in one place. But here's a question. Where are Silas and Timothy right now? I don't know. But you will notice they're not mentioned again. It mentions, you know, that he had come to them. They had joined him in verse 5. When he writes to the Thessalonians, they are with him. But Silas is never mentioned again in connection with Paul. In 2 Corinthians 1, somebody might say, well, you know, your minds are working really fast. You go, doesn't he mention him in 2 Corinthians 1, which is written on the third journey? He does. But he mentions him to the Corinthians about their work together in Corinth. But Silas, also known as Silvanus, he just sort of drops out of it without any mention. Timothy will not be mentioned again until in the 19th chapter, and he's associated with Paul on the third journey, but it doesn't make any reference. And you will take note of the fact that verse 22, when he had landed, He went down to Antioch. There's not the they. So it would seem that Paul travels by himself. And I don't know why exactly. But he goes to Cenchrea. Do you know what woman is associated with the church at Cenchrea later on? Think Romans 16, first two verses. Give you a hint. Starts with a P, but it sounds like it starts with an F. Phoebe. You know, it's the old thing. If phonics made sense, the word wouldn't start with a P, you know. Phoebe is from Cenchrea, servant of the church at Cenchrea. Cenchrea is the port for Corinth. You got the major city there. Corinth didn't sit on the water. Cenchrea did. And most likely, the church at Cenchrea that Phoebe's a part of probably begins while Paul is at Corinth. But what does he do at Cenchrea that's noteworthy? Said he had his hair cut off at Cenchrea, for he had taken a vow. Now let's just stop for one second. What is a vow? In a generic sense. A vow is a what? A promise. I mean, we talk about wedding vows. You know, we make promises. Till death do us part. A vow to God is some kind of special promise made to God. What was the one Old Testament vow that involved hair? Nazirite vow. The Nazirite vow, you abstain from anything connected with the grape. I mean, they not drink wine. They didn't eat grapes. They didn't have anything with the, you know, they couldn't eat a raisin. They also let their hair grow. At the end of the vow, the hair would be cut off. They'd be shaved. They would burn it on the altar. The hair was to be burned on the altar. Most times when you read from commentators, they believe that Paul had taken a Nazirite vow while he was at Corinth. And then when he arrives at Cenchrea, he ends the vow by, you know, cutting his hair. That's possible, I would say. I have a couple problems with that, though. One of them is he is a long ways from the altar on which the hair would have to be burned. Now, the Jews had developed some traditions to where you could take a Nazirite vow and cut your hair off and then just save part of it and burn it on the altar when you got to Jerusalem. But that wasn't what the law said. The second one. Does anybody remember what Paul said in 1 Corinthians 11, verse 14 to the Corinthians? To the Corinthians that he's just left about long hair on a man? It says, doesn't even nature teach it's a shame for a man to have long hair? Now, this is not conclusive proof, I know. But it seems strange that people think he grew his hair out in a Nazirite vow, in the presence of the very people to whom he writes, and he says, it's a shame for a man to have long hair. So, I'm a little skeptical about it being the Nazirite vow. In fact, I wonder if it wasn't that the hair had grown long, if the vow involved the cutting of the hair, just the shaving of the head. We see people sometimes, you know, I've seen, now, if you're a hockey fan, I don't know why you'd be a hockey fan, but, you know, if you are one, they grow their playoff beards. You know, it gets in, they won't shave their beards, you know, and, you know, those, if they make a long run in the playoffs, they get out to about right here, you know. But I've seen football teams as a show of solidarity. Before the season starts, everybody shaves their head. You know, I don't know what that accomplishes, you know. It just, nothing to catch the sweat when you're in that helmet, but they do that kind of thing. I don't know. It doesn't say he had taken a Nazirite vow, just said he took a vow. Why did he take a vow? Special moment of dedication. Does anybody remember though what Solomon said in Ecclesiastes about taking vows in chapter 5. If you take a vow, what? You better carry it out. You know, I wish I knew a little bit more about this. You know, was it a special vow of holiness? A special vow of some dedication? I don't know. I know that he took a vow, and it involved him ended up, he cut his hair. If you know more about it, let me know. That's point number three, and that's a very good one. If you were under a Nazirite vow and you kept it according to strict terms, you wouldn't be able to eat the Lord's Supper. That would seem like a strange thing for a Christian to do. Particularly, again, to whom does Paul write and give the instructions about the Lord's Supper and the importance of remembering it properly? The Corinthians. You know, and here, if he had taken a Nazirite vow in their midst, you know, they would have seen him abstaining from eating the Lord's Supper. John Michael. It could be. Those men took some kind of a vow, but that one clearly involved, to some degree, Old Testament sacrifice, which I'm hoping to be gone the week we have to study that chapter. And we'll save a little more. Maybe that's a good, we'll just save all that for when we get to chapter 21, because we will be talking about the vow again and the sacrifices involved in that. Let's talk about Ephesus for a moment. Think back to something. In chapter 2, I'm on the second journey, not chapter 2, but chapter 16, you remember he was in Galatia? And where did it say that Paul wanted to go, but God directed him elsewhere? He wanted to go into Asia. Asia is this province down here. Ephesus is the biggest city in Asia, the most prominent. It would appear that Paul's had his eyes set on Ephesus for now, what would have been probably over a couple of years. 18 months at Corinth. Add the time, the travel, the time he spent at Philippi, at Thessalonica, at Berea, at Athens. So now he makes it to Ephesus. And he's got Aquila and Priscilla with him. And notice it says he left them there. They're going to stay. But what does he do? What does he always do when he goes into a city? Goes to the synagogue. What's the response of the Jews at Ephesus? Now, they're interested. They said, hey, we want to hear more about this. He said, I'll be back, God willing. If the Lord allows it, I will return to you. I can't imagine how hard it was for Paul to walk away from a synagogue where they're saying, tell us more. But he left Aquila and Priscilla behind, and he sailed on, and it said he went to Caesarea, and which is down here on the coast. It said he went up and greeted the church. Well, you know, is that the church at Caesarea? Most likely the church at Jerusalem. The word up is so often associated with Jerusalem. One reason is Jerusalem sat at 2,500 feet in elevation. But there were places like Hebron that sat at higher elevations. Jerusalem, you always went up to Jerusalem for two things. One, it was up, generally. You had to travel up an elevation. But that was an elevated city in that that's where God's house was. Where God had, you know, placed the temple, the tabernacle, the temple, you know, at the later time. So, I believe he goes there. Then he goes to Antioch. Notice verse 23. After he had spent some time there, you take note of how Luke is moving things along here. He's at Ephesus. He leaves Ephesus. He goes to Caesarea. Greets the church, I think, at Jerusalem. Goes to Antioch. A little time there. Then he takes off again and he's passing through. And the actual verses to get him back to Ephesus are just about 3 or 4. Because 24 through 28 is kind of a parenthesis. It interrupts it. And yet, think about what it is, months that go on. You know, you've got that journey by boat to get to Caesarea. Caesarea to Jerusalem would have probably been at least a couple of days' journey. When Paul leaves Jerusalem to go to Antioch, that's going to take probably a couple of weeks of travel time. Then he stays at Antioch a while there. He spent some time with them. Then he departs from there. And notice what he's doing. He's going over this region in here. He's visiting those churches of Galatia again. And it says that he went through there strengthening all the disciples. He didn't just pass through. He stopped. He visited. He worked with them. You know, I'm sure there were some great conversations that went on. You know, a lot of good stuff. But he's told us about that work. He's ready to move us to the next work. And so we just go right through that. But I don't want you to miss verse 23, strengthening all the disciples. Go back to chapter 14 for a second. You remember he got to Derbe, the last stop, as it were, on the first journey. And what do? They retrace their steps to Lystra, Iconium, and Antioch, strengthening the souls of the disciples. We need to be concerned about teaching people, bringing people to know Jesus, to be obedient to the gospel. But we also need to be about strengthening disciples, helping them to grow. And so, this is the second time that Luke has taken note of the fact that Paul passed through that region, the same region, strengthening the disciples. It's an important work. And so, he's done that, and now we're ready to be introduced to a new character, Apollos. Now, a certain Jew named Apollos, born at Alexandria, an eloquent man and mighty in the scriptures, came to Ephesus. This man had been instructed in the way of the Lord, and being fervent in spirit, he spoke and taught accurately the things of the Lord, though he knew only the baptism of John. So he began to speak boldly in the synagogue. When Aquila and Priscilla heard him, they took him aside and explained to him the way of God more accurately. And when he desired to cross to Achaia, the brethren wrote, exhorting the disciples to receive him. And when he arrived, He greatly helped those who had believed through grace, for he vigorously refuted the Jews publicly, showing from the scriptures that Jesus is the Christ. Apollos. You know, this is kind of a meanwhile. Think about what you've got going. Paul is working his way, third journey. Paul is working his way from Antioch over through this region. And in the meanwhile, Apollos has come to Ephesus. And it said Apollos was born in what city? Alexandria. Alexandria was located in what country? Egypt. Who do you think Alexandria was named after? Alexander the Great, who had actually chosen the place and helped lay out some of the plans for it, though, if I remember my history correctly, he never saw Alexandria because he was, you know, he died before it was completed. But it was a large city. I mean, it's not that old a city. I mean, you've got Jerusalem. People have been living there for well over 1,000 years. Hebron, over 2,000. Damascus. You know, long, old city. This one, only about 300 years old. But it's become one of the largest cities in the Roman Empire. It had a really large Jewish population. Really large. It had, I think, what was considered the world's biggest library. The Septuagint translation, the Greek Old Testament, was largely translated in Alexandria. At least that's the tradition. And so we have Apollos coming from there. And he was said to be an eloquent man, mighty in the Scriptures. Eloquent. The word eloquent, we think of it as primarily somebody who's a powerful speaker that's got great use of the words. The Greek word that's translated eloquent could sometimes mean both well-spoken or well-educated. You know, so, you know, he, and maybe he was both, but he was an educated man. He was said to be mighty in the Scriptures. He knew the Scriptures. He could handle them. And he was fervent in spirit. He was zealous. But what did he not know? What was he lacking? He did not know the baptism of Christ. Verse 25 is very interesting. This man had been instructed in the way of the Lord, and some of the translations say he taught the things of Jesus. What would seem likely is he knows something about the coming of Christ. Maybe he knows when John first, you know, was preaching, he said, "Behold, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world." He identified Jesus. But evidently, he doesn't know somehow. And think about this. It's been 20 years. And yet, he doesn't know about the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. For that's the baptism of Christ is into the death of Christ. He's got this zeal. He's got a powerful knowledge of the Old Testament Scriptures. But he's missing something. Well, he's come to Ephesus, and like Paul would do, he's gone in the synagogue, and he's preaching boldly about this Jesus, this coming Messiah, except he doesn't know all the story. Well, who tells him the rest of the story? Aquila and Priscilla. Let me give you three things, I think three takeaways from what happens. They took him aside. There's a place for a public refutation of error. There's a time, Galatians 2, to withstand somebody to the face. But most times, the most effective, when you're dealing with a good and honest heart like Apollos, is you take them aside and you do it, you know, there. That's the way to do it. Secondly, I think it, you know, significant, it says Aquila and Priscilla, they took him aside. 1 Timothy 2, 1 Corinthians 14 place some very definite limitations on the role of women in teaching. But I think it's clear from the text this husband and wife were a team in teaching him. Priscilla was not in any way taking authority over Apollos, but she was involved in the teaching. But the third takeaway to me is the character of Apollos. This is an educated, cultured man. Who is Aquila? What's his occupation? Tent maker. You know. And he listens. So often when we are gifted with abilities, we can be arrogant, we can be puffed up, we can look down on those with lesser abilities. Not Apollos. Apollos was willing to hear, willing to listen. And so, he gets straightened out. And what does he want to do? He wanted to go over to Achaia. Now, chapter 19, verse 1 says while he was at Corinth. Even if it didn't say it, we would assume Corinth was the place he would go in Achaia. What do the people of Corinth, how much do they like Apollos? Chapter 1, remember, I'm of Paul, I'm of Apollos, I'm of Cephas. You know, Apollos was highly regarded over there. They really liked him. Take note, though, something says, the disciples, the brethren at Ephesus, the brethren, there's already, but when Paul will arrive in chapter 19, there's going to be a church. How big, we don't know. But there's a group there, and they write a letter. You know, every now and then, just as a little quick aside, and I think this is a fair aside from this text, there'll be somebody that you question a little bit about their background, or, you know, where you came from, you have references, and they'll act all haughty and, you know, well, you know, how could you doubt me? You know, what you have here is these brethren, they sent the letter in advance. You'll see Paul will give his commendation to Phoebe. Your brethren are to be, you know, harmless as doves, but they're also to be wise as serpents. Some are not what they appear to be. But when Apollos came there, he greatly helped those who had believed. He vigorously refuted the Jews publicly. Now notice what he showed from the scriptures, Jesus is the Christ. This man, he went from being a fellow who didn't have it all to a fellow who was a great help to the church. I mean, you look at Apollos, and we don't know an awful lot about him. But he appears to be a man who had some gifts, natural gifts. But you don't become mighty in the scriptures just because you're intelligent. It takes a lot of work. You have to work at it, learn. But it also takes humility to be corrected. He was wrong. He didn't have that full knowledge. He was willing to learn it. There's a lot of practical value in looking at a man like Apollos and the way he did things. Questions, comments before we close? I think it's time. Yes. You know, we know, you know, was he ever given a miraculous gift? We don't know. But as you're saying, it to this point in his life, he got it through study and being taught. That's a great point. All right. Chapter 19. I can't tell you how far we'll go, but we'll go with...